is Tuesday, September 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a health update on the poisoned critic of Vladimir Putin as NATO leaders demand Russian transparency.
NATO allies agree that Russia now has serious questions it must answer.
A UK judge denies a bid by accused WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to delay a hearing on extradition to the US. Also ahead, weddings in the age of COVID-19. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump and Democratic rival Joe Biden took swipes at each other on Monday as the presidential election entered the traditional home stretch on the U.S. Labor Day holiday. With a coronavirus death toll approaching 180,000, Trump continued to allude to a COVID-19 vaccine ahead of the November election.
What I said is by the end of the year, but I think it could even be sooner than that. It could be during the month of October, actually. Could be before November.
But with questions about whether political pressures might result in the release of a vaccine before it's proven safe, Biden said Trump continues to fail when it comes to the pandemic.
More than 6 million people infected with COVID. They're heading toward the 200,000, above 200,000 range of people have died from COVID. And still has no plan.
Meanwhile, as the campaigning for the November presidential election heats up, President Trump and members of his administration are forcefully denying a magazine article alleging he made disparaging remarks about military members. Critics, including the Democratic challenger Joe Biden, cite the report as an example that Trump is unfit for office. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Late last week, The Atlantic detailed unnamed accounts of President Trump making disparaging remarks about fallen military members. Elements of the story were confirmed by other news outlets. President Trump has forcefully rejected the report and on Twitter Sunday accused news outlets of working with the Democratic Party on a massive disinformation campaign. Trump's opponent in the November presidential election, former Vice President Joe Biden, said armed service members like his late son deserve an apology if the news account is true.
If these statements are true, the president should humbly apologize to every Gold Star mother and father and every Blue Star family that he's denigrated and insulted.
Biden referenced Gold and Blue Star families, members of whom either served or died in the line of duty. The president says he strongly supports the military and its members.
There is nobody that feels more strongly about our soldiers, our wounded warriors, our soldiers that died in war than I do. It's a hoax. And you'll hear more of these things, totally unrelated, as we get closer and closer to election.
On Sunday, Chuck Hagel, a Vietnam veteran and President Barack Obama's Secretary of Defense, said the allegations in the Atlantic article fit a pattern of remarks Trump has made about veterans like the late Senator John McCain.
He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero.
5.5 years.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
The history of this president over the last 3 and 4 years is pretty clear. And you can go through a litany of past things that he said from his mouth, actions that he's taken, and it corroborates, really, the Goldberg article in The Atlantic.
But Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine questions the timing of any story this close to an election.
A lot of things come out in a campaign, and I think sometimes people, when they only come out during a campaign, people are somewhat skeptical about them. This is, we're into the 60 days, and so I don't know what, impact that's going to have.
Americans now have fewer than 60 days to cast their votes for control of Congress and the White House in 2021. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization says it is unlikely a safe, effective vaccine against COVID-19 will be available for widespread use before the middle of next year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Health officials are urging people to lower their expectations. They say the development of a safe, efficacious vaccine takes time and cannot be rushed. As it is, the World Health Organization reports remarkable progress is being made toward this end. It notes at least 6 to 9 candidate vaccines have begun phase 3 clinical trials. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says many thousands of people participate in these carefully crafted trials. She says a vaccine must be proven to be safe and seen to provide protection against the coronavirus in at least 50% of subjects before it can be approved for public use. She says the safety of the vaccine has to be monitored at all stages of the research, making this a lengthy process.
The good news is the manufacturers are already putting bets on which one's likely to be the vaccine, and they're already working out how they can scale up production of vaccines once we know which ones are the ones we will roll out. But in terms of realistic timelines, we're really not expecting to see widespread vaccination until the middle of next year.
Harris tells VOA that WHO does not tell governments when a vaccine should be made available for emergency or general use. She says that is a decision for countries to make for themselves. However, she cautions against raising false hopes about the prospect of an imminent vaccine that will vanquish the pandemic.
What we've been saying over and over is nobody should be sitting there waiting for the magic bullet, thinking that the vaccine is going to solve all this or that there'll be a wonder drug. What we have to do now is do the things we know suppress this virus. And those are the basics, the hand washing, the social distancing that we're doing, the mask wearing.
She says WHO believes all nations must work together in the search for a vaccine. She says sharing and comparing data is important and will result in a vaccine that protects everybody. Harris calls this a global public good. She says a vaccine not only is essential, but must be provided in all parts of the world, adding that unless everybody is protected, nobody is protected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Russia denies that the Kremlin was involved in poisoning Vladimir Putin critic Alexei Navalny and accused Germany of failing to provide evidence about the poisoning that it had requested in late August. EU and NATO leaders are demanding those responsible be held accountable. On Monday, the Berlin hospital in Germany caring for Navalny gave a cautiously hopeful update on his condition. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
The German hospital treating Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny says he has been taken out of an induced coma and is responsive. The hospital says Navalny's condition has improved, allowing doctors to end the medically induced coma and gradually ease him off mechanical ventilation. It notes that he's been responding to speech, but long-term consequences of the serious poisoning can still not be ruled out. He's been in an induced coma since he was flown to Germany for treatment. Officials had said last week that tests had showed proof without doubt that he had been poisoned with a chemical nerve agent from the Novichok group. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Campaigners are urging Australia to restart a refugee program that has left thousands of people stranded overseas. Australia closed its international borders in March because of the coronavirus pandemic. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
1. Campaigners believe refugees should, like citizens and permanent residents, be allowed into the country. The Department for Home Affairs has appeared unmoved. It has said the border restrictions have been successful in slowing the spread of coronavirus in Australia. 12,700 refugees were resettled in Australia in 2018. The majority were from Iraq, with others escaping Myanmar, Syria and Afghanistan. The government has said Australia has one of the world's most generous resettlement programs and has given sanctuary to almost 900,000 refugees since the end of the Second World War. However, its detention of asylum seekers who tried to reach Australia by sea in offshore camps in the South Pacific has drawn repeated international condemnation. In response, Canberra has insisted the policies were a deterrent and have prevented migrants risking their lives crossing treacherous waters in unseaworthy vessels. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Somali health authorities say the number of maternal checkups and childhood vaccinations have plunged during the pandemic as many people fear catching COVID-19 at clinics and hospitals. Healthcare workers worry the lack of medical care for pregnant women and children could result in a wave of common diseases that take more victims than COVID-19. Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Amina Mustafa and her family were displaced by drought 3 years ago and have since been living in a Mogadishu relief camp. Her three-week-old baby needed vaccinations, but she was too afraid of catching COVID-19 to go to a clinic. She says that it is a common fear among mothers in the camp. Mustafa says that she couldn't go to a healthcare facility because of this COVID-19 is spreading across the world. I feared for my health and that of my child, she says. Mustafa says because they are scared of contracting the virus at the health facility. She says they missed important prenatal and postnatal vaccinations, all because of COVID-19. Somali healthcare workers are alarmed by the sharp decline in child immunizations and visits to clinics during the pandemic. Volunteers like Saadia Ahmed with local health group Sordo are going door to door, urging families to vaccinate their children. But it is no easy task, she says. Every mother, whether pregnant or lactating, are not ready to come to the health facility for vaccination, says Ahmed. Most fear contracting COVID-19. If left unaddressed, Somalia could see a jump in respiratory infections, measles and malnutrition, says the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC. The ICRC says visitors to Somali Red Crescent clinics by children under 5 and pregnant women dropped by more than half in the first 7 months of this year compared to 2019. ICRC health officer Ahmed Noor says the risk of them catching common diseases is high, especially among the vulnerable. He says COVID-19 has badly affected the entire country and forced mothers and children not to come to health centers for vaccinations in fear of the virus. Noor says the fall in vaccinations will result in more and more children contracting contagious disease. Somalia's health ministry admits there is a problem. The ministry's national incident COVID-19 director Abdirazaq Yusuf says they are taking measures. He says that they indeed realized vaccination numbers have dramatically dropped due to the emergence of COVID-19. Nonetheless, Somalia's health ministry is exploring new ways to urge people to embrace vaccinations as a way of preventing contagious diseases and reducing child mortality rates. Flooding around Mogadishu in recent months also risks waterborne disease, warns the ICRC. The floods are further straining Somalia's pandemic-stretched health system and only adding to the worries of mothers like Mustafa. Mohammed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. A British judge on Monday rejected a request by lawyers for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to delay a hearing on his extradition to the United States until next year. They argued it would provide more time to respond to U.S. allegations that he conspired with hackers to obtain classified information. Assange is fighting American prosecutors' attempt to send him to the U.S. to stand trial on spying charges. Unidentified people detained Belarusian protest leader Maria Kolesnikova in central Minsk on Monday and drove her off in a minivan, according to a Belarusian media outlet citing witnesses. Kolesnikova is the last of three female politicians left inside Belarus who joined forces before an August presidential election to try to challenge incumbent president Alexander Lukashenko. And India has now overtaken Brazil as the second worst hit country by COVID-19. Malaysia reported its sharpest rise in new cases in 3 months. And South Korea weighed whether to extend curbs ahead of a national holiday. After months with ships languishing in the harbor because of COVID-19, some cruises have resumed in Italy with new safety protocols on board. MSC Cruises was the first to return to the Mediterranean with its MSC Grandiosa cruise liner, and Costa Cruises followed Sunday when its Costa Deliziosa set sail for a week-long cruise in Italy from the northern town of Trieste. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
COVID-19 has seriously affected the cruising industry, but gradually its operations are restarting in Italy, with passengers booking cruises that have a series of new safety protocols in place. The Italian government gave the green light to cruising companies to resume their sailings last month. However, as the numbers of coronavirus infections have resumed their upward trend in Italy, after having been low during the summer, there are concerns in the cruising industry about how long the ships will continue to sail. MSC Grandiosa was the first large ship to set sail from the port of Genoa in August, with around 2,500 passengers and staff on board, no longer at full capacity. Testing for COVID-19 was mandatory for everyone on the ship before departure. Posters now explain the health requirements, including hand sanitizing and temperature checks. New safety measures on the ships also require wearing protective masks in all indoor spaces and outdoors where social distancing is not possible. Customers boarding the ship express satisfaction with the strict protocols. This customer said the rules are very clear and cruise staff ensure that they are respected. He expressed the hope that it will continue to be this way because it is a security guarantee for everyone. Gianni Onorato, CEO of MSC Cruises, explained that the company's objective is providing a safe environment on board, which will build customer confidence. Onorato said passengers are no longer allowed to disembark independently from the ships for visits ashore, but only for protected organized excursions where buses have been previously sanitized and drivers and guides are tested the morning the ship arrives. He added that none of the services on board have been cancelled, just adapted, like buffets which are now being served, just like in hotels in Italy. He also said there are some 250 empty cabins available if guests need to self-isolate. Like MSC, Costa Cruises also resumed cruising on Sunday with initial sailings only for Italian nationals. Management of cruising companies all cite the great sense of responsibility they have towards their guests in their efforts to resume and continue to operate their cruises. Italy was one of the first countries in the world to resume cruising, but TUI Cruises and Hapag-Lloyd also recently concluded inaugural cruises with no city stopovers from Hamburg. Some of the cruises that have resumed sailing have experienced COVID scares. Dozens of passengers and crew on Hurtigruten's Roald Amundsen tested positive recently for COVID-19, forcing the company to cancel any further sailings. Many of the big names in the cruising world, including Royal Caribbean, Carnival Cruise Line and Norwegian Cruise Line, have cancelled all or nearly all their sailings until the end of October, if not later. The financial impact and job losses on the industry is expected to be huge. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Morocco has been hosting the second and last day of what are being called non-binding political talks between a handful of leaders representing power centers from Libya's two rival governments. Talks appear to be focused on the number of posts that will make up a new governing council. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
As political talks wound down on the second and final day of negotiations in the town of Bouznika, Libya's two rival camps issued a statement saying that they were intent on reaching an agreement. Libya's Tobruk-based parliament spokesman Abdullah Bilhaq told journalists Monday that the objective of the talks is to decide how to apportion posts and not to select any names for those posts. Any agreement, he added, must be taken back to parliament for approval. Libya has had two rival governments since militias forced Prime Minister Abdullah Thani to flee Tripoli in 2014. He continues to govern eastern regions. A 2015 UN-sponsored political accord in the Moroccan town of Skhirat formed a new Tripoli-based government of national accord, which controls western parts of Libya. Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita, who presided over this week's talks, tried to keep an upbeat tone during the meetings. He says that political initiatives from both Parliament Speaker Aguila Saleh and the National Unity Government may push matters forward to a peaceful conclusion of the Libyan crisis. The Saudi-owned Ashark al-Awsat newspaper reported that the main objective of the talks was to reshape the ruling government structure and to bring down the number of leading figures in the country's ruling council from 9 to 3. Libyan Member of Parliament Ali Pakbel told the BBC Arabic service that it makes sense to bring the number of ruling council members down from 9 to 3, since the country has 3 main regions, but added that he opposes picking names from specific tribes or groups, since that is not how to run a modern country. Khatar Aboudiab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that he thinks the military option in Libya appears to be losing steam amid a widespread stalemate, making the political option more attractive. Aya Burwaila, visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College, told VOA that the talks are a promising sign, but that many observers are worried about the independence of the High Council of State from Turkey. Tripoli-based Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara on Sunday. Formal Libyan political talks are expected to get underway in Geneva on September 17th. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Marriage in these socially distanced times, even the ceremony itself, can't always bring couples and their families together. In Africa, some digitally savvy couples are finding virtual workarounds to get them to the altar, including weddings where the bride and groom are thousands of kilometers apart. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to one such African couple who recently solidified their bond while in two different countries. She brings us this story of love, longing, and celebration from Johannesburg.
Fifi and Emmanuel Agwebu got married last month. But in these difficult times of coronavirus restrictions on travel, they resorted to a modern solution. They did it virtually. She was in Nigeria's southeastern Enugu state, dancing herself down the aisle for their traditional Nigerian wedding. And he was in Johannesburg, South Africa's economic hub, where he works as a musician, watching it all online. The bride says her special day was no less special despite the absence of the groom.
On that day, he was like online and we were talking every second. So I didn't feel like he wasn't around. I actually felt he was with me, like he was with me, really. It's just that he wasn't there present, you know. So it was just, I'm sure people will be wondering, why is this girl dancing and laughing and having fun? I just felt he was there, really. Like, it wasn't any different to me, really. So I didn't feel indifferent. I felt good.
Agwebu notes that a close friend of hers did the same recently, virtually marrying with the groom in England and the bride in Nigeria. They're among the countless couples across the world kept apart by the pandemic. But even those who are together can't celebrate in a traditional way because of pandemic restrictions on large crowds. It's crashed the business of Johannesburg party supplier Malebohengulwako. She supplies weddings and engagement parties with champagne walls, transparent shelves of filled glasses in front of an ornate wall. Gulwako, herself a newlywed, says it may take some cultures on this side of the world a while to accept virtual celebrations.
It's going to take a very long time, whereas because... Remember, we also grew up in big families. We always had people, at least a minimum of 7 people around you for your 7th, 8th, 15th, and 21st birthday and so forth. So it's going to be very hard to unlearn celebrating on your own. I'm not sure about the Western culture because maybe you can just do a dinner with like one other person and that's okay. But that's not us. That's not me.
While some couples are delaying their weddings until COVID-19 restrictions are lifted, the Agwebus didn't want to wait to declare their love and commitment.
I felt bad that I couldn't make it there in person. At the same time, when I saw her dance, happily smiling, kind of gave me confidence, all the confidence I needed, and like, okay, she's happy. So at least that's something to hold on to.
The Agwebus plan to reunite in South Africa when flights resume. For now, these two, and countless others, will have to have and hold each other virtually. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And members of the hugely popular South Korean K-pop band BTS are expected to become multi-millionaire shareholders after receiving shares in their label, Big Hit Entertainment, as it prepares an initial public offering. Last week, BTS scored Korea's first ever number one spot on the main U.S. Billboard music chart with breezy disco hit Dynamite. Their first all-English single hit the spot for mainstream U.S. pop fans with a YouTube video garnering more than 284 million views. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.